This is a Glass Box Media podcast.
Lauren.
Mike.
So we host a podcast for Wired called Gadget Lab.
We do.
We do.
Yes, that is correct.
Tell the good people some more about it.
Well, I think the good people should definitely tune in every week because they get to hear me roasting you.
Hey, now.
All right. No, really, what Gadget Lab is Mike and I tackling the biggest questions in the world of technology. I like to think of it as the best of Wired's journalism, but in audio form. We cover the big news of the week in techland, but we also offer our expert analyses and opinions on all things consumer tech, whether that's mobile apps, hardware, startups, cryptocurrency. Mike, what's been a recent highlight episode for you?
We did a deep dive on the group behind the massive Okta hack. Mm-hmm. We also had a great conversation about Web3 and the metaverse. What stands out for you?
Never metaverse you didn't like. I really enjoyed our recent podcast about Peloton. And recently, the legendary tech journalist Kara Swisher joined us to talk all about Elon Musk and the future of Twitter. So I guess we should tell people how they can listen to our pod.
We release a new episode of Gadget Lab every week, and you can listen and follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you pod.
Today on Around the Coin, I'm interviewing Phil Ingram, the CEO of Leprechaun. Leprechaun's core belief is that gaming will be the first killer on-ramp to general consumer adoption of blockchain technology. Leprechaun is building a suite of technology solutions to facilitate mainstream gamer adoption of blockchain technology, starting with the gas-free sidechain Leprechaun. Phil is from Hong Kong. We talked about the changes of the gaming industry over time, the impact that Facebook and Meta have had on the gaming industry, the impact that blockchain has had so far in the play-to-earn category. Phil is very opinionated about the impact that blockchain has had and the impact that it can have in the future. We talked about, at the end of the show, Hong Kong. What's unique about Hong Kong? What makes Hong Kong, Hong Kong? And Phil, having lived there for quite a long time, taught me a thing or two. So very much enjoyed this conversation, and I hope you do as well. I bring you Phil Ingram. All right, Phil, we're live. I'm excited to chat with you.
I'm really happy to be here. A little early in the morning for me, but very happy to be here.
Yeah. And like we were talking about pre-show a few minutes ago, you are in Hong Kong, which I love that because you get to see a different part of the world. I'm in Portland, Oregon.
Well, fans do look the same no matter where you go.
Yeah.
I think they spin as well.
So it spins backwards. I love what you're working on too. Why don't we kick it off there? So you started this company, this project called Leprechaun. Walk me through what the impetus for the company was. Why did you start it? What are you attempting to do in the world?
Thank you. There's a bunch of us, some of us from the gaming world, some of us from the crypto world and some other areas. Funnily enough, I'm originally from the travel industry. That's a long story. But we're looking at sort of the uptake of blockchain in people's lives. I don't necessarily mean people specifically using DeFi services, but just situations where blockchain is integrated into a solution. And we had the realization that gaming, and by that I mean video games, should be the killer on-ramp or the first killer on-ramp for blockchain adoption, but not possibly in the way that is happening right now, which is more the sort of blockchain industry using gaming to sell tokens, but actual video game developers using blockchain in games. Because you know, this shift from the publisher-owned economy to the sort of player-owned economy. A good example would be World of Warcraft, which I have played probably more hours than I'm allowed to publicly admit in my younger days. But you know, you can imagine that World of Warcraft is almost the perfect analogy for what blockchain does. Although it's obviously database and publisher-owned, and very famous cases of people losing their accounts if they did something naughty, like pay someone to level up for them. But you know, it has an inventory or wallet. It has an in-game money system, tokens. It has special items and sort of power ups that you can find which relate to NFTs. Although it gets complicated because obviously there's more than one type of event, and so it's not just your simple NFT. You need a more advanced system. And then finally, you have things like the auction houses in the game, marketplaces. So all those sort of core elements that we've come to know in crypto exist. But we're imagining, well, you know, the way World of Warcraft does it, it's sort of database and C++ driven, and the player doesn't really own anything. But if blockchain were to sort of seep its way in there, then you'd have this very subtle shift that, you know, the items that players work really, it is 6:30 in the morning. Give me a second to warm up. The items that people, work so hard for in game, you can spend 3 hours in epic battles to get that one piece of armor. In the player-owned economy or the player-first economy, you can't take that away. The idea of marketplaces expands when people actually control those assets. And more importantly, the way, you know, you can imagine how guilds can form when it's based around a much more immersive economy. And so the original thinking behind Leprechaun was, if video games incorporated blockchain, they would be so much better, in the same way that Unreal 5, for example, elevates the visual immersion in a game. Blockchain enables you to dramatically extend the sort of economic immersion in a game. And so the original thinking behind Leprechaun was, how could we believe that to be a fact? How can we start that process off? Knowing that was something that wasn't going to happen in sort of 5 days. At that time, when Leprechaun was first sort of announced to the world, which would be, around the late summer of 2020. And we started fundraising August 2020. So, the phrase blockchain games didn't even exist. It was still all about DeFi platforms, et cetera. So, but that's what Leprechaun's originally about. And so the mission that we're set out on, and we've been tokenized live since March last year. So we're, you know, in crypto terms, you could argue we're not really a startup. But everything we're doing, with some stops and starts and a pivot somewhere in the middle, has been about that end goal, because we think that blockchain is completely transform many, many things, but specifically games, because that's what we love. But it's going to be quite a long road to actually get to where it happens in a way in which the blockchain is the silent partner. Because I think the real key to blockchain adoption is when you don't actually talk about blockchain anymore. You don't Evernote, a lot of people use Evernote, and they don't use it because it uses SQLite as its database. They use it because it's a good note-taking app. You know, I think one of the issues with blockchain is it's still all about the technology, whereas it should be about the consumer solutions. And I think we still got a long way to go to make in that transition. But the short answer to your question is, we love games, we love blockchain, and we want to see how blockchain can make games better. And that's what Leprechaun's trying to do, step by step. In its own way.
Mm. And do you think of it as, right now, I my sense of it, of the industry of gaming, and tell me how this is different from the way it really is, but there's a few very large makers, gaming companies, Activision, you could probably
Ubisoft, Square Enix, etc.
Right. And these guys, it tends to be consolidated gaming, because the games that win tend to be very complex and very hard to make. You know, it's not easy to make a game. It's very hard. It's easy to spin up a website. It's easy to spin up a simple app, but those tend to not get traction. And there's, because gaming is inherently peer-to-peer, most of the big ones, you're playing against other human beings, that there's network effects. And the network effects, like similar to a marketplace, consolidate people together on one platform. So you have World of Warcraft, you have the other games that Activision will make. What's the one game? that's like, what's the number one game? It's not World of Warcraft.
Fortnite.
I'm not a big gamer, but Fortnite. Yeah. It's like, God, how many people use Fortnite?
By the way, I'm going to confess, I have never played. But
yeah. Well, it's huge. And it just, it seems to me like, do you feel the future, because of new technology and blockchain, will change that distribution of game makers? So more independent, smaller companies will be able to make really competitive games in some way? Or do you view this as more like blockchain will just be the behind the scenes technology that these big companies use to further their market share?
That is a really good question. I need to unpack that because I can come at it from a couple of angles. I think obviously the particular games you're describing are what we call the AAA. And like Hollywood blockbusters, the more intense, the more expensive the production, the narrower the field is going to become of people that can actually make it. So I don't think that's ever going to change. But the gaming industry is larger. Sorry, I slid off the screen there. I did exactly. The gaming industry is more than just the AAA games. You know, you have your mid-core, the sort of next step. You know, best way of describing that be if you've got the 600, if you've got the $80 games on your PlayStation, which are the AAA, then you've got the $20 games on your PlayStation, which are the mid-core. And then obviously you have things like hyper-casual, et cetera, stuff for your phone. Obviously, the less intense the gaming experience, so gaming isn't just the AAAs, you know, the 100 hours of gameplay, immersive storyline, famous actors doing the voiceovers, et cetera. The gaming industry is much larger than that. So as you get down in complexity and move from blockbuster to hyper-casual along that sort of progression line, then it opens up more and more. And I don't think that will change, because if you're talking about a game like Horizon Forbidden West, which I believe cost somewhere north of $10 million to make, most recently just on the PlayStation 5, that isn't suddenly going to become easier to make that. The gold standard now for that level of game is Unreal Engine 5, which has just been made publicly available. And if you're going to produce something at that level, that's not suddenly going to change. In terms of who makes the games, now that could be subject to change, because here we have a really interesting combination of market forces. There's been some events lately. For example, a few months ago, Steam very publicly kicked off some 25,000 titles from the Steam platform. And it did this because they were, you know, basically games from our sector of the industry that were, you know, getting people to buy tokens or buy NFTs. And the simplest way of explaining why Steam did this would be that, publicly at least, Steam would prefer the SEC not to be on the phone going, why are you promoting the sale of unlicensed securities? Although, you know, in behind the scenes, all the AAA game developers are looking at blockchain. They understand how this could change things around, but they have to tread carefully. So that's from the company side. From the consumer side, we had two famous examples, Ubisoft and Square Enix, two very large game companies. They actually put their toe out and said, well, we're looking at how we can build things like NFTs into games, you know? And vast numbers of gamers in their communities rose up and said, no, can't do that. None of this Ponzi scheme stuff, please. Now, interestingly enough, all of these things, whether it be supplier-driven or demand-driven, all stem from the same thing. This is entirely the blockchain industry's fault. Because when blockchain companies get, oh, hang on a minute, games, what a good way to sell tokens and NFTs. So I could put a set of scrubs on, it doesn't make me a doctor. And the same way that a blockchain company, dressing up as a gaming company, but its actual intent is simply to sell the first 10,000 player characters as NFTs, or we're doing our new open world RPG and we're minting 10 million tokens. You know, that doesn't suddenly make in game companies, and the entire, you know, and that then translated in things like play to earn, you know, You know, if you're going to convince someone like me, because I'm an avid gamer, I've just finished Horizon Forbidden West on my PlayStation 5, and invested most of my weekends for the past couple of months doing it. It's how I decompress from work. You know, you think I'm going to change that really immersive story experience and button mash in Axie Infinity to play to earn? Really? So the blockchain industry, because it's used entirely, because it's thinking like blockchain companies, you know, and they come up with phrases like play to earn and you can earn a living playing games. Well, yeah, we already do that. It's called esports. But for people, you know, games are supposed to be fun. The reason you buy a game is not so you can earn money. It's so you can actually get away from your shitty life for the past week. So when the blockchain industry does this, the gaming industry goes, whoa, hang on a minute. I don't want anything to do with this. You know, so this, the primary reason why, because if you keep making games being about financial instruments, if you keep trying, you know, this is where this ridiculous phrase has come back called GameFi. You know, decentralized finance makes sense. That is an application stack built on the basic premise of blockchain. And all blockchain really promises is immutability. That's it. You can't argue with the contents. That's basically it. Everything else is an application stack on top. So you have this wonderful application stack for DeFi, although it's extremely hard to use, and clearly no one from marketing was ever involved, because if anyone ever thought about the customer experience, we wouldn't have invented MetaMask. But the game stack on top of blockchain, you don't take DeFi and drag it across and call it GameFi. Because that implies, for example, my World of Warcraft reference again, that you're playing World of Warcraft, you kill this monster, you click on its body, select all the items on its carcass, you want to transfer them to your inventory, click go, and MetaMask pops up and goes, "That'll be $10, please, and come back in 10 minutes. That's not usable game UX. Gaming is about the enjoyment, the user experience. It's not about financial independence or sovereignty, which is what DeFi is about.
Now, I
wax lyrical on this subject. You touched the let's talk about.
Yeah, good. So in gaming, though, there is often this is way prior to blockchain. It predates this, where there's games. There seems to be a quantitative score. Like you're at yes. level 5, right? Dwarf, or you've got this many coins. And very true that those numbers, those levels, for the most part are kept within the ecosystem of the game.
Yes.
And the purpose of those are really to just give you a sense of progress or accumulation of value, make you feel like you're building something. When I think of the word gamify, I think of there's a quantitative assessment of progress. And that is the thing that games do really, really well.
Yes.
That end up keeping people for long periods of time. And then there is the idea that you can buy things in games using this in-game currency that's already been developed. Then there's also, I think, a widely accepted idea that you can buy into a game. So you can use real-world dollars to purchase some mm-hmm. item. Then people can trade. So where do you feel like the rub is? Do you feel like it's a branding thing only, or?
I think everything you've just said more eloquently than I did at the beginning when we started off about, you know, what it is we believe blockchain can do for games. You've actually done, I'm sealing everything. I'm going to use what you said first because, you know, I was still doing my 6:30 in the morning waking up thing and it was getting the words out. But you just said it very eloquently. Everything about the way people experience the progression they make in games, the protection of that information is an argument for blockchain. You know, If your level is stored in that way, then a company's servers, can't be hacked or lost or damaged such that information is lost. The amount of in-game currency or platform or ecosystem money that you have earned through play cannot be taken away from you. You've just described how one of the ways in which blockchain can make games better perfectly, but the difference is all one way I suppose I'd put the difference is the subtlety. You know, at the end of the day, if you go around saying, talking about the, you know, earning money, you want to get the IRS to look at something. just start talking about earning money. There's a difference, yeah. You know, there's a difference between that and basically the saying that no matter what happens, no one can say you don't own the things that you won in a game. A lot of it is in phraseology, because technically, you know, Fortnite, we used the example of Fortnite before, you know, Fortnite has a massive industry around it involving things like skins and et cetera, you know, very blockchainable. But, you know, we need to be careful that we don't start turning this into something where everyone's income tax return has a line on it saying, how much did you earn in Fortnite?
Let me pause you there, though. Let me just throw a parallel analogy out to see if it resonates with you. So I feel Instagram in the early days had no projection of monetization. Same with Quora.
Yeah.
And these companies allowed people to post pictures or write articles, not even enticing them for future potential revenue opportunities, just purely for the act of posting, sharing, and social benefits of seeing what other people have to share and offer. They did offer likes. They do offer quantitative measurements of progress with followers and likes. But they're not claiming that this is a platform for you to make money. That has changed to a large degree when you can advertise on the platform and they pay out a rev share to influencers. YouTube does this especially well.
More importantly, actually, it's the third party method where Instagrammers basically say nice things about stuff because outside of the platform,
right,
someone has paid them a lot of money to do so.
And in both cases, the thing that people were doing in the first place, whether it was writing or sharing pictures or gaming, it's the thing that people are attracted to. And then to me, it seems like, well, we're going to make this a sustainable occupation. We're going to make this so you can keep doing what you love and you can make money on top of it, meaning that you don't have to go and do your city job on the side. Is there a trap there? Is there something that...
I think... I was looking up some figures just to make sure I was up to date. It's very difficult to pull accurate figures, but I saw somewhere in the region that by 2025, the play to earn, this sort of blockchain gaming segment, and let's be very, very clear, an entirely new category has been born. Excuse me. I won't deny that. And, I'm seeing figures as worth somewhere around $40 billion by sort of 2025. I looked that up last night. But again, I don't trust half the statistics that are out there, unless it comes from someone like McKinsey, where it was researched and verified, etc. There's no doubt there's this huge category that's created. But I think this is where you need to have we need to have more sort of global awareness. Where play to there is one area where there's already a sort of income derived from playing games, and we have this concept called esports, and there are people playing in tournaments around the world and earning quite money and becoming big stars, competing everything from Fortnite to Pokemon Go. I mean, if there's a game where people can compete for the highest score, someone's doing it as an esports event. But most of the I don't have accurate statistics on this, but anecdotally, most of this sort of play to earn category where it's making a difference is in much poorer countries. So, for example, there are entire villages in the Philippines where the village is everyone's playing Axie Infinity. Now,
to make money.
Yes. To drag a village out of poverty. That's where the sort of money that you can earn is not going to get someone to give up their city job.
Where does that money come from? So say this village is playing Axiom Infinity. They're supposedly taking the money that they're earning in the game and they're cashing it out in their Filipino dollars that they can then use to buy food. Yeah. Where does the money originate? Who's putting money into the system?
This is not an area which I've researched extensively, so I'm not going to proffer that my understanding. But it's a setup infrastructure like this will always be an investment opportunity for a particular strata. So I think, you know, there's money going in setting up villages or setting up groups of people to do this. And then, you know, it's a bit like borrowing some money to buy a computer and then basically it worked out.
I mean, the answer could just be investors, right? Investors.
The answer is, I think there's an investment class within this that sees the opportunity. Now, I think we have to separate sort of discussion about different ways of categorizing the sort of explosion of games and blockchain from sort of any sort of socioeconomic commentary. You know, at the end of the day, if anyone ever comes up with a way in which people in less fortunate circumstances can improve their lot, that is a good thing. Only the most cynical could say that's not a good thing. My point of this is this, why I'm separating is this is what I can sort of consider video gaming, and what I saw the primary motivation behind playing a video games for the multi-billion-dollar market that sits out there, because there's this number of people playing play to earn, there's this number of people playing video games worldwide, that the sort of there's the motivation for the majority of the industry is still and always will be about fun. It is not your day job. It is what you do to get over your day job and get away from it. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, we have this entirely new category. But I think play to earn is one of those dangerous phrases that can pollute the conversation for people like us who are talking about making video games better, improving sort of economic immersion in games, changing in-game economies, you know, irrefutability of ownership of the items that you the items and assets that you win through your labors in the game. I think it's very different from this sort of play to earn category, which does still sort of drive the image of button mashing, all day and night to sort of earn crypto. And I think whilst there is an absolute industry that's now come about, the play to earn industry, it can't be confused with the mainstream video game thing.
The way you've outlined it to me feels like a zero sum transfer of wealth between people who are investing in the future potential earnings of a gaming project and people who just purely want to earn money to play a game. I mean, unless there's real value derived and people are willing to actually pay for a game purely for the entertainment value, then you're not adding any value, and it's just a matter of time before that energy fizzles out. Do you feel like that's a scenario?
In my zeal to separate those two things, yes, there's always I think you have to look at it. I often go back to World of Warcraft because it's so easy to make the analogies and it's easy to understand. Mm-hmm. If I play World of Warcraft and I end up with duplicates of legendary items, I can go to the auction house and I can basically convert those things into money. At its simplest, the difference is that in the blockchain version, no one can take my tokens away. No one can take my assets away. In the publisher first version, you know, if some transgression, in fact, in the height of World of Warcraft, it became big news. You'd see on GameSpot and IGN, you know, someone else had their account shut down for alleged infractions of page 962 of a thoroughly obtuse, you know, a user agreement made between you and Zen and God, I can't remember the name of the publisher of World of Warcraft now. My brain's gone dead. Blizzard. You know, to me, that subtle shift, I mean, you know, building an economy around games, you know, it's still part of the game. I think there is a company we're working with called Hayabusa, and Alan Cruz, the CEO there, is ex-Ubisoft, and he's building a game called Tower's Gate. It is an Unreal 5 engine-based city survival game where you're not the protagonist, but you're thrown in this huge world and you have to survive. And the entire economic engine is going to be built using blockchain. So that, for example, in the mobile, it's a transmedia enterprise. So like in the mobile version, you know, you can trade all your commodities, et cetera. So you can play the game basically with a gun trying to stay alive, or you can become a titan of industry. And you can choose, but he's designing. So he's doing the first sort of, example of something where using blockchain, using smart contracts to manage a city economy for the player who's thrown into it. This really ambitious what he's doing, but that's still using the blockchain to actually create a realistic economy, that can be seamless. But once it's controlled by the smart contracts, it's not subject to fiat. By human intervention. So as an example of the sort of, you know, I think it is still about fun. It is about protection and sovereignty of your account, and it does enable, for example, the monetization around the outside of, you know, the consequences of your gameplay. But again, that's still that game fun community centric thing. That it's where I'm heading towards, and then the sort of blockchain play to earn thing, which is an absolutely genuine category, and has absolutely created a new industry. But again, that is not the mainstream. I don't think people, I don't think that's PlayStation games aren't going to be basically, you know, all play to earn in the future. There's still going to be an immersive storyline, and actually, and the whole experience. Think they're not the same thing. They're related, but they're games, but they're not the same thing.
What drew you, if you look at yourself, say from a third party perspective, and say, okay, this guy Phil is really into gaming, what was it in your life that you think sparked the interest to pursue gaming, and really where do you draw value from it on an ongoing basis?
Interestingly enough, I'm not originally from the video games industry. And in fact, before this job, I wasn't from the crypto industry either. I used to be VP of marketing for a travel company. I used to work in luxury travel.
Were you playing games at that time?
Oh, I've been playing games. Yes, I've been playing. I am a young looking 52 now. So I've been playing games since. I had my first computer I got in 1981. It was a level 2 TRS-80, which had like a low resolution block graphics. And I was playing Defender on that, which I would load from a cassette tape into the machine. So yes, I've been playing games since for 40 years. And I've got,
so let me ask you this. What is it about people who play games, we'll call it semi-professionally, they're on there every day, they're playing for multiple hours every day. What is it about these people that draw them to gaming? Is it a just pure love for the imaginative world creation and story? Is it sort of a depressing or demoralizing real world life that they want to kind of escape from, some combination of that? Or are they generally skew more technical? They're interested in the technicality of the software and the gadgets that are in the game.
I think all of
I'm trying to understand the psychology. Yeah.
Yes, you're taking me into an area where I will be. It's not based on academic knowledge or study, but I imagine the answer is all of the above. that's a reason. You could ask, why are some people drawn to certain genres of games? You know, there are some people who primarily play first person shooters. That would include me. And some people play puzzle games hyper casual on their phone, which I don't. So I think it's such a huge, and obviously as technology improves and as technology changes, the ways in which you can be immersed in, by the way, I apologize, the changing light outside because it is dark.
Oh, that's fine.
their sun's out. Try and a little bit. I think different people are drawn to different types of games and different types of gaming experiences. I, for example, never got into like combat games like Street Fighter. Wasn't my thing. And we have consoles in the office, and I watch people playing Street Fighter. One of our team members brought in their old PlayStation 3, and so we're playing Street Fighter on that. And I'm just watching the button mashing. I'm going, that's not me.
Yeah.
So
there's probably some combination of randomness, people just getting into something early and then developing a skill set and a passion for it.
Well,
and then maybe
some habits,
personality type.
Yeah, particularly those of us who, I think the reason why, not all people my age are sort of, play games the way I do. I suppose it's a matter of exposure. And of course, our teen brains are very impressionable. It's the same reason, I believe, that we still tend to listen to the music we listen to around the ages of 13, 14, and 15, because that's the stuff that's imprinted on our brain. And that's where what we tend to be drawn back to. So I think a lot of early experiences. So had I been in the arcades with friends, when Street Fighter was coin operated, maybe that's the route I would have taken. But it's just wow, the light really is changing. Hang on.
This is kind of what I'm getting to is looking forward and saying, do you feel intuitively? And I know we can't know. But with the introduction of Facebook's pivot into Meta, there are billions of dollars they're pouring into Metaverse, the existing massive industry of gaming, which to me very clearly represents the Metaverse, right? You're in the game. You can look at your hands.
Well, ask any game developer, wow, virtual worlds. Hang on a minute. We were doing that 25 years ago.
Yeah.
Metaverse is just an MMORPG.
So here's the question for you. Do you feel that Meta is going after the existing gamer community, or are they seeing a future in which the vast majority, or at least a lot more people in society, percentage-wise, are going to be engaging in virtual reality more so? Because gaming, I would imagine that there's a percentage of people in the population that are going to be interested in gaming, and it's not likely to take over everyone. Unless we're in the Matrix style reality, I guess.
We're a long way from that. that's another question with a lot to unpack as to whether Facebook. I personally doubt whether Facebook or Meta is going to be sort of the winning player in this space. I think we're at a very interesting, I want to come at this from a couple of ways. And the first way is in terms of the companies and who's going to play. And then remind me to come back to specifically about VR. If we go back, and as I said to you pre-show, I also was part of the dot-com boom based in New York for about 3 years during the final height and the fall of that particular industry. If you look at who, first of all, how the internet came about. Before the internet, people used things like AOL and CompuServe. And I think the metaverse is still, for want of a really simplistic analogy, in the CompuServe AOL stage. We have all these metaverses. In other words, we have all these online services. And I think in terms of how that shakes down, into what I think many of us would hope becomes the metaverse, where interoperability simply becomes part of the infrastructure. And I can take my online identity and basically hop from world to world rather than having all these accounts. And therefore, because with the blockchain assumption, basically, I need to have this token to go in that world. And I need to have this token to go in that world. And I need an NFT from these people to go in that world. That's the blockchain industry trying to work out how to make money before they build a product by selling tokens and NFTs. That can't be the long-term way in which the industry goes. So whether or not, if I use search as an analogy, when the dot-com boom was happening, Google didn't exist. It was point, it, you know, it was Lycos, Alta Vista, Yahoo, etc. All of whom have now gone. And now we have Google, and then Microsoft comes along with Bing. I think I used Bing once. But you know, the that's in the same way, I think the presumption that Facebook, which actually, I mean, we got to the point where Facebook is for old people, and like me, and although I've barely posted anything on Facebook for 2 years, I'm too busy, I've got a job. But you know, to assume that Facebook is going to be the future of the metaverse, who knows? I don't think so, and I think it's very dangerous to presume, because I would forbet. We all thought Alta Vista and Lycos were the center of the search universe 20 years ago. And where are they now? So I think it's very dangerous to assume. Plus also, I think arguably maybe Facebook just has one too many black eyes. You know, and I think a lot of people looked at the sort of Decentraland style graphics of that famous video that was put out. And I don't know. I could be wrong. They might make all the right decisions.
Yeah.
Our Facebook account is the way we log into the metaverse. But I don't know. I think it's very dangerous, because I remember the dot-com boom. All the companies that were then, none of them exist now in what I suppose is the state where the internet is as ubiquitous as it could become. You know,
20 years from now, the percentage of the population that is playing more than 1 hour of virtual gaming per day, is that higher or lower than today?
Probably higher, or yeah. Has some virtual usage, uses the virtual world in some way. But I think this actually takes me back to the second thing that I wanted to bring up. I personally feel that this sort of, you know, everyone's talking about, well, virtual reality, and everyone, of course, the mass market is looking at things like a certain Spielberg movie recently, Ready Player One, and they're sort of imagining that's how the existing in the metaverse will be. Well, that sidesteps the one thing whenever it was difficult, you never actually saw what the guy was physically doing. To compare to, so when he's dancing through the air, you know, notice how they never cut back to the actual real world, you know, in this treadmill. So there's a lot of things that we're not there yet. But also, I also remember 20 years ago, when we didn't really have Wi-Fi, that if I wanted to check my email or get online, I had to either go home or go to an internet cafe. And we've now got to a point, a generation later, where everything is in this tiny little handheld device that I can put in my back pocket. Suddenly, with virtual reality, we're back to the appointment system. Oh, I'm going to meet my friends online in the metaverse. I've got to go home because, damn, I have a pair somewhere. I don't know where they are. Because I've got to wear these big virtual things.
Yeah.
Or I'll go to a VR cafe or whatever. I don't think, you know, after a generation of getting to this, by the way, arguably the metaverse is simply any layer in which you can interact with your friends without requiring physical presence. And if you want to have a philosophical debate, but you know, are we suddenly going back to putting these big, huge things on our head and that's how we experience? No, I honestly think AR is much more the, you know, because you need to be able to take it with you. And then, for example, you could be sitting at a chair and you put your AR, you put the little attachment on, you flip it on, and you're able to have a sort of AR chat, you know, with your right. friends without being able to not see if a bus is about to run you over. So I think I think there's a lot of presumptions. It's so exciting. You know, VR, I do VR chat occasionally. It's fun. It's clunky, but it's fun. I play VR games. You know, I have Facebook got my money. I have an Oculus Quest and I play things like table tennis and stuff in VR for a little bit of fun. Actually, it's a little bit of movement too. So, you know, I'm not knocking it. I'm a participant, but it's still so early. And I think we've barely scratched the surface in terms of, yeah. of how this is actually going to play out.
Do you think the impact of blockchain is underrated or overrated for the sector of gaming?
I think it's underestimated. But again, I would say that like any enabling technology, and if the simple fact, blockchain itself really is about the immutability of data. Everything else is an application stack on top. And the fact that blockchain says I own something and there is no one on earth that can take that away from me, that alone is utterly transformative when applied to any commercial activity, from playing games to bank finance, whatever. That simple fact that you can't take my shit, that is transformative. So then you can build all sorts of imaginative application stacks on top of that basic premise. But again, I would say, and this, there's a few people that I take reference. For example, I'm not someone who would share videos. There's a few people that I take note from of things to say, and one of them is Steve Jobs. And I remember this famous video, he was just, I think, after he'd taken back over Apple, and some engineer was really upset that they cancelled one of the programs. And he's saying, this was really good technology. And Steve Jobs basically said, well, yes, but we've cancelled it because you created a technology and you turned it into a product. But not once do you say, what customer problem am I solving? You know? And the same thing I'd say with blockchain and the stage we're at. As someone who was in the dot-com boom, that was all marketing-led. And by the time companies had worked out how to productize, they'd spent so much money, they could never earn it back. And so the likes of pets.com and boo.com all went bust, and a couple of people came out winners like Amazon. 20 years later, I come into the crypto industry, and I see exactly the same thing, an industry awash with money, you know, looking for places to invest. But it's a product-led industry. You can see that the marketers, the people that sort of examine customer needs and wants, weren't really involved. The experiences, the way we interact with the technology tells you that. And I think, it's all about the blockchain. Blockchain comes of age. Blockchain becomes a pervasive, substructure upon which many things are built, when you never actually mention blockchain. A game is good because a game isn't good because it uses blockchain. A game is beautiful because it uses Unreal, and a game may be economically more immersive because it incorporates elements of blockchain technology, but the games are meant to be fun. A TV program is meant to be watchable. Finance is meant to be safe, secure, and profitable. Blockchain is an enabling technology, and the real breakthrough is when people go back to solving customer problems, not just say, oh, it's blockchain, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, yeah, totally. That makes a lot of sense. And I think the acceleration of blockchain and gaming is going to be similar to crypto, related to the comparable option. If these gaming companies are using their centralization, then people will adopt blockchain faster. But if we really trust Activision and they're not losing people's accounts or, modifying the database, then adoption will be slower. I think that's the same in countries that have corrupt governments and banking systems. You just see blockchain take off faster because people genuinely want that problem of safety and security solved. Where in the US, not a big deal. Like, I'm not worried Chase is ever going to steal my money. Yeah, it could happen. It has happened. I don't debate that. But the chances that it happens to me, I view as very, very low compared to other people in other countries.
It's actually a really good point. And, both in terms of trust and also infrastructure, in the same way that, for example, in many parts of the developing world, wireless technology leapfrogged fixed line technology and enabled us to get telecommunications into people much quicker. Blockchain does have the potential to really change things for the unbanked, because the number of people there's what, 7-something billion people on Earth, a terrifyingly and desperately sad large number of those are unbanked. And and blockchain has a possibility to bring financial access to people and bypass the banks in the same way that wireless bypassed fixed. So it has the potential to do a lot of good. So it's not just about the trust, but also about the infrastructure as well.
Yeah. You're in Hong Kong, which is something I'd like to touch on for a minute. So you've been there for a while, a couple of decades plus, and
that was very kind of you to soften the blow.
I have a good friend who lives in Hong Kong, and I have a sense of the size. It's very small. He bikes around the whole island.
Bigger than people. Small for me, but bigger than people imagine. Singapore's very, very.
How is it compared to Singapore?
Many times. Singapore. Okay.
What's your? I want to ask you specifically about life there and the culture there. So the culture there is very international. Like you were saying pre-show, it has the third largest market behind the U.S. and London. Market exchange. What types of people get attracted to immigrate into Hong Kong, and how is that changing over time?
Hong Kong is probably. I'm not going to divert too much into sort of any political commentary or anything, but Hong Kong's always been a very easy place to for most people move in and out. That's changed a little bit in some areas, like journalism, for example. But Hong Kong is still probably one of the easiest places on earth to start a business. The burden of what you need to do to actually say set up in what our case would be a limited company in Hong Kong, and you don't even need to be a permanent resident of Hong Kong to run a business here. You need to be one or have a visa to earn a living from a business, but to run or as an income, but to have a business that makes a profit from which you take dividend, you don't even have to be a Hong Kong permanent resident. So, with very low taxes, Hong Kong has a tax rate of 16%. In fact, the income tax, both corporate and personal, the income tax in Hong Kong is such that there's a sliding scale, the more you bands, just like anywhere else in the world, or a flat rate, I think, of 15.5%, and you pay whichever is the lower. So once you get past a certain point, you just pay after allowances. So, personal allowances and things like charity and allowable deductions, like for education expenses or whatever. So Hong Kong has the burden of living here in terms of the paperwork you have to fill in is super simple, and the burden of running a business here in terms of the paperwork and the regulatory environment is very, very simple. It has first world infrastructure in terms of the banks. Hong Kong HSBC, which is a very famous world bank, plus Standard Chartered and Bank of China, all three of which make our banknotes. Interesting fact, Hong Kong, the government doesn't make the banknotes. The three top actual banks do. And so you can get banknotes which have the emblems of three different banks on them. Interesting fact.
Does that fact there parlay into a tangible difference in either the circulation of money through inflation
Not at all. It's just that the notes are printed. The Hong Kong dollars are the notes are printed by the three what we call the note issuing banks. But in terms of monetary policy, the Hong Kong Monetary Authority is in charge of that. The business burden in Hong Kong, it's very, very easy to run a company. The reporting requirements are simple. The tax regime is super simple. Hong Kong also has a single point of reference. So, for example, in Hong Kong, there is no value-added tax or sales tax. There is no dividends are not taxed. There's no capital gains tax. Things can only be taxed once. So, for example, if I own a company and I pay myself a salary, I may pay myself a salary up to, say, $1,000 a month, because that's tax-free income tax-wise. And then I would take the rest as a dividend. Dividends aren't taxed because they're after profits tax. And therefore, because Hong Kong only taxes money once, Once profits tax has been taken from a company, dividends are tax-free. So if I get paid a dividend by any companies I'm invested in, or I take a dividend from a company I own, I pay no tax. There's no capital gains tax. So if I sell stock shares or crypto for a profit, I pay no tax on that. Only pay tax on once. Also, Hong Kong's a duty-free port, with the exception of petroleum products, which would include perfumes, etc., alcohol, and what's the third one? Tobacco. There is no duty to land stuff in Hong Kong. So I can import, for example, I buy stuff online from like Amazon or Etsy, and it gets shipped from the US. Just comes straight through. No customs considerations at all beyond outside of those three. So yes, from a financial burden point of view, we have it pretty easy here. So from that point of view, it is still one of the world's best places to start a business, and one of the primary reasons why I'm still here.
Yeah. And have you noticed an increasing number of crypto companies moving there?
Well, I think a lot of people. Yeah. Hong Kong is absolutely awash with the crypto industry is strong in Hong Kong, really strong. There is a huge infrastructure growing up here, building up here. I think one of the difficulties, and there's a lot of VC money here as well. I think one of the difficulties for us has been, because at the moment Hong Kong's still a little cut off from the outside world in terms of movement. You know, if you land in Hong Kong, you've got to do 7 days quarantine and can only come out if you test negative. We still have those restrictions. It's hard at the moment to bring talent in. And so one of the problems we've had is we have an immense amount of entrepreneurial activity within the crypto space, from finance to blockchain, to gaming, et cetera. But it is a little difficult at the moment. We're operating on a bit of a starved pool of talent, and hopefully things will change that we can start attracting talent to Hong Kong, and start bringing people in again, which, the Hong Kong government has always been very pro. It's a very important signal for them to show the world, notwithstanding all the other things that are sort of going on that you might read about, that Hong Kong is still a place to attract international talent. That's one of Hong Kong's primary purposes, is to be a place where people can. That's why, for example, in Hong Kong, those of us who are permanent residents but not Chinese citizens, we can vote in elections, etc. You know, that permanent residency is it's very different from most countries that require you to become a citizen. The permanent residency.
Yeah, it seems like there's a strong sense of national pride that they people in Hong Kong feels like it's a country.
Now we head into things where I'm very, very careful. Hong Kong isn't a country. Hong Kong is, obviously, it was a crown colony of the United Kingdom until 97. It was handed back to China. To go from Hong Kong to China, you have to go through Hong Kong immigration and customs and then through Chinese immigration and customs. So whilst this is China, we are in Hong Kong, is part of China. From a practical point of view, it's its own customs region. It has its own immigration force. It has its own rules. So, you know, for example, an American does not need a visa to enter Hong Kong, but would need a visa to enter China, for example. So it's different.
I see. I love it. I love hearing about your perspectives. What are things that you've soaked in over the years as you've accumulated knowledge in the space? Are there particular people that have written that you followed, books, articles, tweets, videos, things that you wanted to reference?
Okay. I'm going to show my age here. I'm a reader rather than a YouTuber. but if I was, it's interesting. There's some people that, from an academic point of view, there's a couple of names that immediately come to mind. From a leadership point of view, I've always one of my favorite reads of all time is Good to Great by Jim Collins. I think anyone who has aspirations to in a leadership role to do that effectively and to do it the right way, I would highly recommend that book. I'm not sure how old that book is now. It's been 10, 15 years. I'm not sure. But Good to Great by Jim Collins. I've always enjoyed him. Recently, because I only just recently assumed the CEO position of Leprechaun, I was actually the chief marketing officer before, and then we made a change, and I recently was appointed to the CEO position. And I went through this entire process, you know, where, and I was thinking about purpose, and then I suddenly remembered, and I went back to someone that I used to read a lot. There's a guy called Hubert Joly. Now, Hubert Joly used to be the CEO of Best Buy. He's the guy who basically turned Best Buy around, you know, after the previous CEO was fired after various scandals. And Hubert Joly, who's now a professor at Harvard, he writes a lot about this concept of finding purpose. And I actually went through a sort of finding purpose exercise in the company recently, so I was attracted to him. I have an old boss of mine. Just after I came back from the US to Hong Kong, I was actually appointed to as a managing director of Cable and Wireless's Internet Services Division in Asia. And my old boss, a guy called Mark Franceschetti, and just because I've managed to get a shout out for his name, I can send the link to him when this is published. He was transformative, I think. He was my first personal mentor that took me to took me on the leadership path. In terms of modern things, I do like me a little bit of Vaynerchuk. I do like the occasion. I think he speaks a lot of sense. But apart from that, you know, I'm not a mad YouTuber or anything. I think I'm more likely to be watching. My addiction on YouTube now, which I'm going to confess, is I don't know how this happened, but I got into reaction videos. I don't know how that happened, because they're weird, but I just like people reacting to other stuff. You know, that's sometimes what I do to switch my brain off. But in terms of, those are a few names that come to mind. You know, I've just been through this process of trying to reignite passion and just tighten the focus of a company. So, you know, a lot of the old names from my education days, you know, the Porters, et cetera, all those tools that we learned, very, very useful to remind yourself of those basic tools to try and unpack problems and find focus. But yeah, those are the first two names that came to mind first three names that came to mind when you asked that question.
Awesome. Well, Phil, congrats on all the progress with Leprechaun. I hope you guys crush it. I love what you're working on.
Thank you. And
thanks for coming on today. Appreciate it.
No, thank you very much. I enjoyed it. I apologize. Next time I'm going to make you get up at 6:30 in the morning so I can be more than one coffee in.
Yeah, for sure. All right, my man. Take care.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to Around the Coin. If you enjoyed the show today, consider giving us a quick review wherever you listen to podcasts, tweet about it, or text it to a friend. We really appreciate all the support and growing that we can. If you have any guests you'd like us to bring on or feedback for us, don't hesitate to reach out. We would love to hear from you.
This is a Glassbox Media Podcast.